Hergé's last work. He died at only 26. For me, he was writing about the good things in the human frame, our capacity for love, for spiritual engagement. And this is not a sentimental thought. It's also a subject of study at Magdalen College, Oxford, where Brian Greene studied for a while, and where Robin Dunbar researches how friendship is maintained or lost, and where Professor Jamie Krems, now at UCLA, was based. Are you often asked, perhaps, what friendship has got to do with science?
I am asked that. People love to talk to me about their friendships, but when it comes to actually studying those friendships, especially studying them empirically, people balk at the idea because it's this magical, sacred relationship that sort of defies being scienced.
Given that human beings evolved over hundreds of thousands of years, of course, and it wasn't just the hunters and collectors, small groups, but as the numbers got bigger, the only way I would have thought, perhaps, that you could run a larger society, if there were friendships, social cohesions, rather than people in small tribes fighting each other all the time.
Yeah, so one of the most beautiful explanations of friendship is that it functions to provide us preferential social support. And so it's not necessarily about the good of the group, but the good of the individual. So imagine a scenario where a drought hits your village and you're in need and some of the other community members who might also be your friends are in need, but the village next door, there's your very good friend. And if she has the resources to give them to you, she might very well give you those resources, helping you survive. And she might give them to you over other people who are in similar need as you, meaning that she's preferentially supported you. And you can also contrast this with the idea that when we're most in need is when we look like the worst bets. Strangers are not going to invest in us the way that our friends do. But friends have a stake in our continued welfare, and so when we're in need, they help us. And it's rather a beautiful thing.
One of my favorite colleges is a beautiful college, and of course you were there with my namesake, Robin Dunbar, who's famous for Dunbar's numbers of 150, suggesting that your friendships can be, before they become just acquaintanceships, people you see in the distance but don't really know. That number is important, and the Dunbar's numbers become famous not only when they were tested, for example, with social media, because the number of regular social media interactions you had turned out to be the same number as well.
Yeah, so to the best of my understanding, even though we might interact with many more people on, say, Facebook, or we might have 900 friends, we actually really only spend good chunk of our interactions online with about 150 people. And then in real life, it's the same thing, Dunbar's number of 150, the people that if we saw them at an airport, we'd feel comfortable going over and saying hello. Or if we saw them at a coffee shop, we'd feel comfortable sitting down and saying hi. It still seems to be 150. And one of the very cool things that Robin often talks about there is how that's reflected across cultures as well. So we have military groups that are limited to 150. The number of Christmas cards that people send out, it's about 150. It's kind of fascinating.
Did you follow up any of his work while you were there?
So we worked together on conversation size constraints and how people often end up having conversations with three or four people. But when it gets to be a larger number than four, when you have five people, the conversation often splits in two. So we explored why that is. And we also looked at hyperlink films, which ostensibly aim to show the world as it is with these myriad social connections. But in reality, our Stone Age minds are still winning the day. So we can only have the number of connections that we have evolved to manage.
That four or five is very interesting because my partner says it's best if you want to catch up with old friends, have four of you at the table, because the minute there's a fifth or a sixth, there are then two conversations going separately.
Absolutely. So right on. And it's so true. We see this over and over again. And so you can imagine people that are very good party planners or dinner planners, they know how to navigate our evolved conversation constraints.
Is there any difference between the friendships that men have because I'm reminded of ways in which men could be in a band of brothers or doing sport when there's automatically some kind of cohesion. If there's no cohesion, you get killed or you lose the game. But it might be different, this is the assumption, with women. Is there a difference?
How long do you have? We could talk about this all day. And some people don't like to discuss these differences. And yes, there are more things in common with men and women's friendships than not. But they're also wildly different, and we have to acknowledge this reality. So for just a few examples, women tend to have dyadic or one-on-one, really emotionally close best friendships. They have a lot of self-disclosure in that friendship, which can become ammo for the other person should the relationship break up. And in a short amount of time, there's also more turbulence in that best friendship than in men's friendships. And the female-female friendships, best friendships often do break up more than men's friendships. In fact, I was in a room of scholars and I was asking them about a time that they had really lost a friend, potentially acrimoniously. All of the women had a scandalous story for me, and all of the men looked at me putting their heads to the side like a confused dog. Like, lose a friend? I don't lose a friend. But so by contrast, men's friendships are sort of these group-based friendships. They're activity-based rather than conversation or self-disclosure-based. So they're looser group-based friendships that are less prone to turbulence, more likely to stay together. And men often seem to reconcile better after a fight than women do. In fact, Joyce Benenson and some of her colleagues looked at this in sport. I think they looked at football matches and saw that men were more likely to touch the players on the other team as a form of reconciliation, a gesture that even chimps do. So there are wild differences. And in fact, there are even inherent paradoxes in how we think about just women's friendships because they remain wildly understudied.
You mentioned chimps touching each other to make up. Very interesting. How far back does it go beyond chimps to monkeys?
Yes, there is speculation that what we'd call friendship exists in quite a few social species. So lions, cows, horses, Spanish wild mustangs, in fact, form really close female-female relationships. And if another horse tries to sort of horn in on one's best friend, the horse that's threatened by that will bite and kick the interloper. So it does seem that certainly in great apes and any number of social species, there are what we'd call friendships.
Is it the case that as we get older, it is harder to make friends?
So that seems to be true. All the data seem to be pointing in that direction. Although there's also some evidence to suggest that older folks jettison friendships that are not working for them and are happier. They have fewer but higher quality friendships. But particularly in Western nations where people move around a lot, partners might move for jobs and all of that kind of thing, men especially have a harder time making friends in their 20s, 30s, and so on after college. Women also have a difficult time making friends. And so if you look in the last 5 or 10 years at The Atlantic or The New York Times, you'll see all of these stories finally recognizing how hard it is to make friends. We have a pretty good idea that it is true, why it's true, and how to fix it. We are very far behind.
It's such a big and important area. How do you manage to concentrate on your actual research and what you're doing?
Oh, I like it better than everything else. And hopefully my husband isn't listening to this. So I think about it and it's joyful. It's what I think about when I am walking to the other side of campus. So I think about it all the time.
In Oxford, a person studied chemistry. Her name was Margaret Thatcher. Well, it wasn't then, but when she became prime minister, she was quite famous for saying there's no such thing as society, only the individuals and families that make up the rather large group. Now, that was a rather cynical way of looking at what is possibly exacerbated by the new technology, the falsely named social media. It strikes me that it's more antisocial media, frankly. Is that a fair interpretation of what's going on at the moment? Because people talk about the atomization of society. In other words, you've only got, as Thatcher was implying, these tiny numbers and there's no cohesion and it's all balkanized.
The availability of the internet and your ability to find your own group had a lot of promise, and I think we all saw the possible benefits of that. But now it's very clear that you can exist in an echo chamber or a tiny group of a few people that share what might be a seemingly even bizarre belief, like the earth being flat. I don't know if it's pushed us necessarily toward our families. I think it's possibly pushed people toward little echo chambers. Or some work by Jonathan Haidt and others suggests that it's pushed particularly young folks and young women, and particularly young democratic women, into anxiety disorders. So its promise has not necessarily been fulfilled. It's scary.
Why Democrat women?
We don't know. Yeah.
One can guess.
I should probably not guess, but some people have made a series of remarks as to whether or not this is even true, but the data seem to suggest that Democrat men and women are actually reporting greater anxiety than Republican men and women. And that's kind of wild because we often see much higher anxiety in women than men. And that this other factor is moderating it, at least in U.S. young adults, is something that we need to pay attention to, make sure is true, and figure out why it is affecting our youth at unprecedented numbers.
As we've been hearing on countless news programs, Jemmy Krems is a professor at the University of California, Los Angeles.